The World Tomorrow. Garner Ted Armstrong brings you the plain truth about today's world news and the prophecies of the world tomorrow.
And greeting friends around the world, how many of the following statements do you believe are found in the Bible? Peace on earth, goodwill toward men. Spare the rod and spoil the child. And I can't repeat the other one on the air, but it has something to do with it's better, and then it has to do with a harlot, and then it has to do with the ground, and so on. A lot of people have told me that one's in the Bible too. No, it's not, really. Did you know that none of those three statements are found anywhere in the Bible? People take a statement out of the book of Proverbs having to do with punishing a child with a rod, which doesn't mean, by the way, a coat hanger or a curtain rod, the way some people might think, but merely was an English word translated out of Hebrew that really means the shoot of a branch, such as a little willow switch or something very, very lightweight, which would hurt all right, but which certainly would not injure or bruise. And they think that statement, spare the rod and spoil the child, is in the Bible. It isn't there. There are scriptures that sound somewhat like that, having to do with a child will not depart from the way he is reared or is taught, but there is no such statement in the entirety of the Bible as, quote, spare the rod and spoil the child, end of quote. The other statement I made is one that I imagine most people would immediately think, oh man, now I've really done it, really stepped through the thin ice, really gone out on the limb and sawed it off behind me, because I said there is no such statement in the Bible as peace on earth, goodwill toward men. No, not in the original writings. It isn't that way. Actually, that is in a statement that was supposedly made by angels in the account in the second chapter of the book of Luke, about verse 14 and 15. In this series that I'm going through in the subject of the Gospels, I like to bear down on the fact that there are many diametric opposites to what we've always thought and what the Bible really says. And this is just one more example. There are several examples in this program I have for you this time, as a matter of fact, as we're going along in the narrative of Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, and how they fit together. Because they're interwoven accounts, each one like a reporter, a writer who was seeing it from his own point of view, inspired not to make any errors, but nevertheless sometimes one gospel writer will illustrate one point, perhaps in more detail than another gospel writer. And you have to have all four, as the Bible itself says, as I've been saying so many times, line upon line, precept upon precept, here a little and there a little. Now, at the present time, I'm using this harmony of the Gospels, which has the RSV translation in more modern English, but you can get that out of any other version you would like. And just check me on that, because you will find that that verse in the second chapter of Luke literally does say, translated out of the Greek, peace on earth among men of goodwill. Actually, that is exactly what the angel meant to say. On earth there will be peace among men of goodwill. You can see how totally different the statement is then of seemingly just an empty, hollow sound of peace on earth, goodwill toward men, meaning it seems to be that God has goodwill toward men, when actually it is a statement that has a little more prophetic note than that. Peace on earth among men of goodwill. Unfortunately, we don't have very much peace on earth today, but then that's because we don't have very many men of goodwill, leaders of government and the like. Well, coming on a little further in Matthew, the parallel account over here of this Annunciation and the appearance of the star, did you know that there is no account whatsoever of those wise men meeting Jesus in a manger? You know, you'll see these little Christmas plays about Christmas time of the year, and it will show these wise men coming into this barn. You'll have a lot of hay around and munching goats and camels. And they walk in and open up this little gold coffer. You've seen it in motion pictures. You've seen postcards and paintings and pictures of it. And it's rather firmly fixed in your mind that there was a star that appeared. And maybe a few hundred yards over there, or a mile or two or three, in a pasture somewhere just outside of Jerusalem, on a nice rolling hill. Now, you have the idea it was all covered with snow. But you never did really worry about that, because it talked about shepherds keeping their flocks in the field. And I guess that nobody stops to think about the difference between the Christmas card that might show just a huge, beautiful, albeit cold, an uncomfortable winter scene. We like to think of a white Christmas in Jerusalem that year, so we like to think of Jerusalem, which, while it does rarely get snow, sometimes it does get snow in the very middle of the winter, it never would get snow at the time of the year that Jesus was born, sometime probably in the latter part of September. You say you didn't know that? Well, why not? Most scholars of the Bible know it. They look it up. They know exactly with regard to the beginning of the autumn, which was the harvest portion of the fall of the great second harvest of the year in Jerusalem, that according to the beginning of Jesus' ministry, according to the Passover, according to the prophecies about him, according to his own age, that he had to be born sometime around September, probably the latter part of September. And he was not born on or anywhere near December 25th. So when it says there were shepherds abiding in the field, that's true, because you see that statement is in the Bible. But there were not shepherds abiding in the field in the midst of a great deep white snow. Because you see, they always got their flocks in, and when they had laid up hay and forage for them in the barns and the lofts and the sheds and the sheepfolds and so on, those sheep were gathered around and kept close to buildings and human habitation where they could be fed and sheltered and were not out in the fields during the snowfall. So that's another opposite. But there are quite a few of them in the second chapter of Matthew about Herod privately calling the wise men. And it's quite interesting because people have been arguing ever since, which star was that? What could that have possibly been? And I guess they feel that these wise men are the Magi, from which we take the word magician. And they were from some country over to the east of there, by the way, and it may have taken them, now listen, I'm going to shock you, it could have taken them close to one solid year to get there. Now, it may have only been a month. It may have only been 2 weeks. It was not a day or two. It was quite a period of time. Let me tell you why I believe the Bible strongly indicates it may have taken close to a year as we go along. Herod, verse 7 of Matthew 2, privately called the wise men and learned of them carefully what time the star appeared. Because it was the time of the star appeared that marked the time of Christ's birth, and Herod knew that. Now, a little later on, you will see, in the second chapter, in verse 16 of Matthew, that it says, Herod, when he saw that he was mocked of the wise men, was exceeding wroth, and sent forth and slew all the male children that were in Bethlehem and in all the borders thereof, from 2 years old and under, a horrible slaughter that history corroborates, by the way. Another thought that perhaps a lot of people have not come to is that Jesus grew up in Nazareth, but he was born in Bethlehem. And having been born in that area, in all the borders of Bethlehem and the entire area surrounding it, made him absolutely unique, and there was no one else having been born in that portion of the land of Judah within 2 years of the age of Jesus. He was the only person of that precise age, unless someone had moved in or emigrated in since. He was the only native-born son of Bethlehem that survived, because every other one of them, 2 years of age, was killed. 2 years of age and under, even to the newest-born baby of a day or so. And you'll notice that it goes on to say in verse 16 that Herod did this according to the time which he had carefully learned of the wise men. And what was it he had learned of the wise men? He had learned what time the star appeared. Now, it had to be a gamble, a horrible, bloody, unbelievable slaughter, but it had to be a gamble even for a man in Herod's position as a puppet king under the Roman governorship, and he was risking one of the most unbelievable riots you'd ever heard of in all of your life, in his own life, from assassination. To do such a thing is to wipe out all these babies. So you stop to think. If he had known that Jesus could not have been more than 1 month of age, would he have risked killing all those other thousands? If he had known that Jesus could not have been more than 3 months of age, would he have done that? If he had known 1 year, I think perhaps he guessed the baby could have been as much as 9 months on up to a year, and he was just going to make sure. And so because there was some question in his mind as to exactly how old the baby might be, he ordered the death of all children of 2 years of age and under, according as the Bible says, to the time which he had carefully learned of the Magi. Now, when the Magi saw the star, was it a real star? If you believe the Bible account, it wasn't. You can't believe it was actually a celestial body up in the heavens that is still there today, and yet people are arguing over which star was it that the wise men saw. Why do I say that? Well, just read the account. It says that the star did appear, and they began to journey. Herod called them in and wanted to know what time the star had appeared. He sent them to Bethlehem and said, "Go and search out carefully concerning the young child." That's verse 8 and 9 of Matthew, the second chapter. "And when you have found him, bring me word that I may come and worship him." And they, having heard the king, went their way. Now you see, they're indoors and out. They're sleeping and lodging. Here's other proof of that. "And lo, the star, which they saw in the east, went before them." They did not go according to calculations, triangulation, or celestial navigation, according to a fixed star which was in the heavens. It went before them, till it came and stood over where the young child was. Now, how in the world are you going to understand a star acting like that? If it was any kind of a celestial body, such as a meteorite or a comet or an actual star, then it had to be one of the most fantastic miracles you've ever heard, because most stars, of course, unless it's just a little asteroid, are far greater than the Earth. Our own sun is a yellow dwarf, an orange dwarf, it's called. It's much smaller than most stars. There are billions upon billions. They think about 200 billion billion in the Milky Way alone. And most all of those, I imagine the broad majority, are larger than our own sun. The sun is a star. The others that we see, some of them such as Mercury and Venus and Jupiter and Mars and so on, are planets. And they are only reflecting the light of our sun. There may be billions upon billions of other planets that are in the orbit of yet other solar or stellar systems, however you'd like to call it, and the reflected light from them may be so dim that we would never be able to detect it here on the Earth, yet there could literally be billions upon billions of planets. So this was not a star, in the sense of astronomy, that came and stood over where the young child was. Well, what was it? Well, let's find out how the Bible uses the term. Over in Revelation, the first chapter, in verse 20, you will find an example of where Jesus is in a divine vision, is pictured as having stars in his hand. And it talks about angels, how he is surrounded by angels, and they are sometimes referred to in merely biblical language, descriptive language, as a star. As a matter of fact, Satan the devil, before he was Satan and when he was still Lucifer, which was shining star of the dawn, was named as if he were a star. Angels are used interchangeably sometimes in biblical language with a star. Very likely, that star was not actually then a celestial body, meaning a lifeless planet, or a huge gigantic helium-hydrogen explosion like an atomic furnace giving off all the heat and the light and the energy as our sun is at all. A star in the classic astronomical sense of the word, very likely it was an angel that came and stood over where the young child was. They were following a heavenly guide, not celestial navigation. At least if you're going to just accept the Bible at face value and let the Bible interpret the Bible and believe what the Bible says, that's what you're going to believe. Now, if you don't do that, fine, that's your problem, not mine. Believe whatever you'd like. But the point is, the Bible plainly makes it clear it could not have been a celestial star at all. And it was actually a miracle that was provided of God, and an angel was used to lead them and to guide them where the baby was. Now, notice a little later on another unbelievable example of these opposites between what people have believed and thought, what we portray in art and literature and our greetings cards and all of that, and what is actually the truth. Was Mary, was the baby Jesus, the whole family, still in the manger by the time the wise men arrived? Well, it says here in verse 11, "When they saw the star, they rejoiced with exceeding great joy, and they came into the house and saw the young child not tiny baby, it now uses a different Greek expression, young child, with Mary his mother. And they fell down and worshipped him and opened their treasures. They offered unto him gifts, gold and frankincense and myrrh. Now, since there are three categories of gifts, people have always assumed there were three wise men. Here's another opposite. Jesus was in a house, it plainly says so in your Bible, a rented home, apparently. It might have been the home of a relative, but I deduce that it's rented simply because when they first came to Jerusalem, it said everything was filled and they couldn't find any place. The inn and everywhere was filled, any place that would take in travelers. So they had no abode of their own, or perhaps even people that they knew that closely, because they were from up around the area, remember, of Nazareth, and on up into the hill country of Judea, as it was called. And he was, in that sense of the word, a mountain dweller. Now, we wouldn't look at it if you're from Wyoming or Montana or Colorado, of mountains on that scale. But if you've been to Jerusalem, if you've been to Israel and up to Nazareth, you know that when you get to Nazareth, you get up high enough that the mountain air is very, very cool, and you see conifers and big pines and various of the conifer and type of tree there. Maybe some of them are, I think a lot of them are cypress, but there are a number of pines and different types of trees. And it was fairly steep up and down up in that area, from there clear up to the Sea of Galilee. And even today in the modern news, you hear the Golan Heights, and there's some big mountains all the way up to Hermon, which is covered with snow the year round. So there were some pretty big hills up there, all right. And they were from that part of the country. And you can see, if you will write for this book, that the real Jesus, that very likely Joseph, his father, was a contractor of sorts, that he was a major builder, that he was not a carpenter in the sense that you might think of a fellow with a hammer in his pocket and a pocket full of nails and hammering away. As a matter of fact, most carpenters would be insulted if the average person thinking Jesus was a carpenter, that all he had to do was hammer a lot of nails. But they have a great deal more to do than that. And many is the carpenter who gets the knowledge and the experience that he really gets into engineering and a lot of other sciences as well, and can actually build a home from the ground up. And that is more than just the merest meaning of carpentry. Well, in that day and age, it had to do with stone. It had to do with mosaics. It had to do with heavy beams and timbers, and with using winch and pulley, and all types of ratios of gears and of leverages and the like. And they had to be very knowledgeable, because those homes and those buildings that were built during that day of the heyday of Hellenistic architecture in the city of Capernaum, in some of the buildings that were extant during the boyhood and the young manhood of Jesus, were glittering examples of some of the best of Greek and Roman architecture. And Joseph was a successful man. God would not have allowed the father, who was to actually be the legal father and the one to rear that baby on up to age 12 and beyond, and then he disappears at some time beyond that, and we don't know exactly how old he was, but perhaps we have always taught in Ambassador College classes that he was about 40 when they were married. The reason being that there are many examples in the Bible of how a person who was being called in a great time of testing in his life or for a great challenge was very mature at about 40 years of age, was actually entering the prime of masculine life. Moses was 40, for instance, when he was called out of Egypt and had a very great challenge set before him, another 40 years of wandering, and Moses was 80. And you'll find then that David was 40 at the time of his coronation, and he reigned for 40 years. So we've generally thought that the reactions of Joseph, when he discovered that his wife was pregnant and expecting, and his first assumption was it was illegitimate. It wasn't until he had a vision, a dream, an angel actually told him, fear not, and all of the rest that you hear in the Bible, that this was of God, and that his wife was going to bring forth a child which would be of God, the very Son of God. But his initial reaction before he knew that was not that of an outraged, incensed young man. It was far more judicious. He thought only of her. He was going to put her away. According to law, he would have to, but he was going to do so privately because he did love her and he didn't want any scandal attached to her name. So we'd always felt that that may have indicated he was about 40. He could have been older than that. He could have been younger than that. But the story of the Gospels is very clear. One thing is sure, that the last time you see mention of him is by the time Jesus is about 12 years of age, and from then on, Joseph disappears. But Joseph had a big family, as this booklet, The Real Jesus, will prove to you. Jesus was a member of a family of at least 7 children. Does that shock you? There's another great opposite. I can't help it if it's in the Bible, but it names his brothers. It doesn't name sisters, but it does say sisters, plural. His brothers were named as Joseph, Jude, James, and Simon. That's 4. Jesus makes 5, and he was the elder brother. And then it says sisters, plural. It could mean 3 or 4 or 7 or more, couldn't it? But let's be very, very cautious and very extremely pessimistic and say it was only 2. It had to be 2 to satisfy the Bible statement, sisters. So by any method of reckoning at the extreme smallest number of children possible, Mary went on to become the mother of a large family, according to our standards today, of a minimum of 7 children. That's also in the booklet, The Real Jesus, because the real Jesus of the Bible and the Jesus you've heard of all of your life may just possibly be 2 completely different persons. Many of these accounts about his birth, his boyhood, what happened during the visit of the Magi, the star and what it was, was he in a house or a manger? Simple things like that you would think people would stumble across in the Bible, and yet the great church organizations don't even seem to know or to teach the truth about some of the simplest little matters that you wouldn't think are all that important. It doesn't make any difference to your life whether Jesus was in a manger or a house. It's just that I illustrate the point that if such simple things and seemingly unimportant things can be taught as an exact opposite and can get lodged into your mind, then how many other points are there in the Bible of perhaps even an important spiritual nature to your own personal life and to your hereafter that you might have also misunderstood or might not have gotten into your mind just the way they really are? Well, it says here then that they were in a house when they saw him. He had been moved into a rented house at this time, and probably they were spending a fair amount of money to rent a dwelling place that was suitable for a group that size. How long they stayed there is a moot point. Actually, they departed into their own country by a different route because they were warned about Herod. But the point I mentioned about the 3 wise men, well, you can't prove there were 3. There could have been 30, there could have been 4, there could have been 7, and there could have been 2. It just says wise men, so there was more than one. And the problem is it only lists 3 types of gifts, plural, made of gold. Then there was frankincense, a kind of expensive incense, and myrrh, an ointment or an oil, a sweet-smelling one. And these would be like very precious spices or incense and things that were very, very expensive, a gift that would be kept perhaps for years. I don't know the exact nature of myrrh and how long it would be kept or anything of that type, but there could have been many different types of pieces of gold, which would have been like a tremendous windfall for the family, and no doubt either were stripped away from Jesus at the time of the confiscation of all the other properties that belonged to the family, because you see, with him actually hanging there on the stake about to die, that he told John that he was to take his mother to live with him. And he said, "Behold your son, woman," and so on, "you're to go to live with him." And that was made very, very clear. So Joseph was dead by the time of the crucifixion, and they had taken away the home that Mary could have lived in, and she went to live with John. So probably that gold was spent at some time along the way, either to conduct the affairs of the ministry of Christ, or perhaps for family affairs and the other children before. You write for this booklet, The Real Jesus, and you'll find out a lot more about Jesus Christ that you probably didn't know before. Now it says here there were 3 kinds of gifts, but there is no indication that there were 3 wise men. It could have been. I'm just bringing up the point that there is no reason to assume there were 3. It could have been 12 or 20 or only 2. Now it goes on to say that they were to flee into Egypt, which they did, and that a prophecy was being fulfilled in Hosea 11 and verse 1 that said, "Out of Egypt did I call my son." That's in verse 15 of Matthew, the 2nd chapter. Very quickly, the account goes through the death of Herod and how a dream came to Joseph in Egypt, telling him, verse 20, Matthew 2, to take the young child and his mother and go into the land of Israel, for they are dead that sought the young child's life. And when they got up there, they found that Archelaus was reigning over Judea in the room of his father Herod. And they didn't even go into the area of Judea then, but the family went around it and went on up in northern Israel to the parts of Galilee and dwelt in a city called Nazareth, that it might be fulfilled which was spoken by the prophet, that he shall be called a Nazarene. The parallel account in Luke, the second chapter, in verse 39, only lists one verse. And when they had accomplished all things that were according to the law of the Lord, they returned into Galilee to their own city Nazareth, whereas Matthew lists a large number of details that Luke does not mention, and neither John nor Mark say one word about it one way or the other. The only other statement you have prior to the 12th birthday of Jesus about his early boyhood is in Luke 2 and verse 40, where it says, "The child grew and waxed strong, filled with wisdom, and the grace of God was upon him." That's the only statement you have. It might have taken place anywhere from about 3 B.C. to 8 A.D. That's right, B.C. A lot of people think that B.C. ended with Jesus' birth, and from that time on, it's all A.D. No, Jesus was born probably in 4 B.C., the way we count time today. Because, you see, it was hundreds of years later that some fellow in a monastery was sitting fiddling around with a quill one day and decided to make up a calendar, and he got a few things wrong. And by the way, that's not something that I am espousing. That's not my notion. Anybody who has studied any of the biblical helps and some of the biblical books available, has gone to a theological seminary or has researched anything at all about biblical chronology, knows that Jesus was born sometime about 4 B.C., It goes on then, following that, to introduce the subject of the parents going every year to Jerusalem at the feast of the Passover, and how Jesus did that according to the custom of the feast, and it then gives the account of how Jesus tarried behind in Jerusalem at age 12, and how he was being sought by his parents. They thought he was lost, and they came back and found him saying a lot of things to some of these wise men in the temple, and he said something very strange about what he was called to do. I'm going to save that for next time, and also what it says about the boyhood of Jesus. But in the meantime, why don't you write for this booklet called The Real Jesus, that answers these questions about whether or not Jesus was literally a householder, a homeowner, whether or not he paid taxes, what was he like, what did he look like, what does the professing Christian world say it knows about Jesus, and look at the many opposites that you will see, the method of his birth, what he was prior to his human birth. Was he a man, just a good man, or a prophet? Was he only human, or was he God? Many don't know. Many don't know why he came. They don't know how he called his disciples. They don't know exactly what he looked like. Millions are not sure he even died, yet the Bible says he did. Many think that it was just his body. And what about the thief on the cross? The thief wasn't with Jesus when he appeared to his disciples over 3 days later, yet supposedly Jesus was going to go to paradise, and yet when he came back, resurrected, he said to his disciples, "Touch me not, I have not yet ascended unto heaven," and the thief wasn't with him. Those questions need to be answered too, and they are. They're answered logically if you just understand the Bible the way it was written. So write in for the current number of The Plain Truth, and also this booklet, The Real Jesus, and request the booklet, What is the True Gospel? And all you need to do is to request it by sending your letter to Post Office Box 345, Sydney, New South Wales. Be sure to tell us the call letters of your station. We need that. That's all. There is no cost, but tell us the name of the radio station to which you've been listening, the call letters, and then send your letter to Box 345, Sydney, New South Wales. Until next time, this is Garner Ted Armstrong saying goodbye, friends.
You have been listening to The World Tomorrow. If you would like more information, write to Ambassador College, Box 345, GPO Sydney, New South Wales. That's Ambassador College, Box 345, GPO Sydney, New South Wales.